Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. Here in the Coast to Coast command bunker, we've got goosebumps. What is the central question of human existence? Some of you might say it's this: are we alone? Meaning, is there someone else out there or in here with us? Though I think most of us would say the answer to that question is, what comes next? What happens after we die? And there are subsets to that question, many other questions under that. Do we go on in some form? Can that form communicate with this one? Can we reach across the chasm from that other world, assuming it exists, to this one? Or does it all end in death? Is it wishful thinking to imagine that we go on, to hope that something in us is eternal? For most mainstream scientists, these issues are for philosophers or religious leaders, not for serious, fact-based researchers and investigators. Well, maybe they're wrong. You know, when you're young, it's a lot easier to put aside or disregard the question of what comes next. You kind of mentally set it aside. You don't really want to think about it. Even if you're religious, no one's in a real big hurry to find out. To paraphrase a country song, I want to go to heaven, but I don't want to go tonight. As you get older, though, and here I speak from some experience, it gets harder to get it out of your head. When the end is closer than the beginning, it creeps into the edges of your mind and into your thoughts, whether you like it or not. You're forced to make plans, to put things in motion, to make sure your affairs are in order so you don't leave your loved ones with a mess. So you think about it, at least in practical terms, and you wonder, what comes next? When I heard that Leslie Kane was working on a book about life after death, I thought, oh, that's good. She's such a seasoned and thorough journalist. She's meticulous and fair. We've seen her work on the UFO topic and know that she does her homework when she digs into a topic. Maybe she can tie together a lot of the loose ends in this kind of research to make some sense of seemingly disparate odds and ends related to the subject, near-death experiences, OBEs or out-of-body experiences, mediums, apparitions, reincarnation experiences in which little kids remember past lives, the kinds of things that we talk about on this program. And sure enough, she's done that in spectacular fashion. But what blew me away in reading her new book are the personal experiences that were part of her journey down this road. And as I said, goosebumps. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, Leslie will be here to take the wraps off this new groundbreaking and I'd say inspirational book called Surviving Death. Buckle up for that one. Then in the second half of the program, Preston Dennett returns to Coast to talk about his latest work. It addresses that other big question: are we alone? Preston has written 13 previous books about UFO cases, sightings, incidents. The latest work is different, though. The stories he will share with us tonight are much more up close and personal. Encounters that occur and reoccur over years, in which there are conscious memories, as well as missing time, physical effects, multiple witnesses, chilling stories of being face-to-face with people, beings, who are from somewhere else entirely. True Accounts of Contact, Inside UFOs is the book, and Preston will be here later tonight. Luckily, there's really no news to speak of or discuss tonight, right? Nothing happening in Washington this week, all quiet there in D.C., everyone getting along just fine. I did see a news alert today, a Fox News alert sent out on social media. It read, alert, the president is working at the White House this weekend. That's good, right? He's working at the White House, but alert? I'm not touching that one. Webmaster Greg Bishop and I have culled together some newsworthy items unrelated to the happenings in the Capitol from various media sites around the world. We call it Knapp's News, and you can find it on the Coast to Coast AM website. Among the stories we featured tonight, whether we live on beyond death or not, most of us seemingly want to put it off for a while, right? Scientists have done some work that seemingly reverses the aging process in mice, reverses it. My guess is they will perfect this in humans about a month after I kick the bucket. And then it'll be over the counter like aspirin. You can read about it if you're interested on the website. Also, a really fascinating story about a guy who decided to become a hermit. He walked into the woods, left his car on the side of the road, stayed there in the woods by himself for 27 years. Fascinating account. Also, today marks the 20th anniversary of the Heaven's Gate mass suicide. Remember those folks? A guy named Marshall Applewhite and his big-eyed countenance. He used to send me stuff, I think almost weekly, updates on the Heaven's Gate group or cult. On this date, cult members checked out for good, poisoned themselves so they could join the space people. We have a story that recounts some of the things that happened there and a few things you may not know. Along with a new release of UFO documents, this time from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, as compiled by the Black Vault. We have the link and other items in Naps News. And while you're on the website, check out how to become a Coast Insider. It's still a great deal, about 15 cents a day if you sign up for a year. You can listen to the program anytime you want, as many times as you want, on just about any device. You also have access to an archive of hundreds of previous programs. And while you're there, you can find information how to subscribe to George Norrie's television program, Beyond Belief, which further explores many of the same topics we discuss here. With that, let's assume the position. You'll want the dog and cat inside with you for this one. I've got two cats at my feet at this moment. This command bunker of Coast is infested with them. Put on a pot of Joe, slide into the silky jammies and the bunny slippers. Plop yourself down in that comfy chair, turn down the lights, and turn up the radio, because we're ready to rumble. In a moment, Leslie Kane, Surviving Death. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. No one gets out of here alive, that's for sure. We all die, whether we want to think about it or not. What happens afterward has most often been left to religious leaders, philosophers, mystics, sometimes to hucksters. But are we on the cusp of a new understanding? Is there evidence that could convince the non-believers, even skeptics? Leslie Kane is an independent investigative journalist known for pioneering human rights work in Burma. As director of the Coalition for Freedom of Information, she fought and won a FOIA federal lawsuit against NASA to get them to release lost records on the Kecksburg, Pennsylvania incident. And we probably know her best on this program for her book, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. Her newest work is just as thorough and convincing as that excellent book. It's called Surviving Death, A Journalist Investigates Evidence for an Afterlife. Leslie, welcome back to the program.
Hey, George. It's so great to be back with you. Thanks for having me.
I mentioned at the beginning, I don't know if you heard it, that I was really glad to hear you were working on this topic. I fully expected to be thrilled and entertained by your book when it came out, but I did not expect this. I did not expect the personal stuff that we're going to discuss. It really blew me away. And here's kind of what I wanted to start with. What worries me in talking and reading about this subject, how much does wishful thinking affect your take on it? I think all of us have there's a danger for all of us. We want it to be true, don't we?
Right. Yeah, certainly. I mean, and when I set out to do this, I had no idea that the kinds of experiences that I had, which I did include in the book, would even happen. You know, I thought it would be mainly a research book. I mean, I knew that I could test certain things, which I did, but a lot of it I never thought it would be as startling and as dramatic and as evidential as it was. So, yeah, you always have to be looking out for the wishful thinking aspect, though, of course. So that's something I tried to be discerning about while I was writing the book.
I was curious whether you think it's a natural sort of a melding of your subject. You know, previously you'd dive feet first into the UFO topic and did such great work on it, whether it was a natural sort of a progression to get into this, or whether are those two topics on a road to the same place, or have you always had this interest?
Well, I mean, I've always had an interest in this one as well as the UFO topic. I just didn't focus on it as extensively in the past as I did the UFO topic. And once that book was complete, then I was able to turn my attention more to this. So it wasn't, yeah, so I've had a kind of curiosity. I've read about it over the years. And then when my good friend Bud Hopkins died, who many of your audience may be familiar with, I was with him when he died. And that was sort of a catalyst for me to start asking a lot more questions. Because when you have the experience of being with a dying person, I don't know, it to me, I found it incredibly profound. And it just sparked my curiosity a lot more. And so I just started to focus on this stuff a lot, you know, fully, 100%. And it's just, to me, absolutely mind-blowing and fascinating material. And it was a journey of discovery as I went along, I'll tell you. Whereas, you know, UFOs I spent 10 years on, and it was pretty much, it didn't involve me, the book. You know, I was just a journalist reporting on events. But for this book, it was much more of a personal journey than that one was.
Well, that's how it affected me in reading it. You lay the groundwork, a lot of other cases, a lot of other evidence that we're going to get into. But what really sealed the deal are the personal experiences. Having known you and knowing how credible you are, wow. We'll get into those stories.
Yeah, I can promise you they're not exaggerated in any way. I would never do that because, that's not what I'm about. There'd be no point. So, yeah, they were amazing for me. I never expected such things to happen.
Well, we'll hear them. Give me your thesis. What's the premise for the book?
Well, the basic thesis, George, is that if you pull together, there are lots of different areas of where this question of consciousness, does consciousness survive death, has been researched. But it's been from a lot of different areas, and what I've done here in this book is to try to consolidate the absolute best information, the most credible, from the best sources, the best cases, so that if somebody wants to know, well, what do we actually know about this question factually? They only have to read one book rather than going and trying to wade through the zillions that are out there, some of them being factual and some of them not. So I just sort of made a synthesis of what I think is the best. And what's interesting to me is to show how they all hold together, how they interweave, how they one supports the next. And when you sort of address one question, there's a natural question that then comes up, and then you can turn to other evidence that supports that question, and you can go further and further. But all of it kind of weaves together and all points in the same direction, which to me is highly suggestive that there is some kind of survival of consciousness. I certainly can't prove that. Nobody can prove it. But there is evidence that is very suggestive and therefore it's perfectly rational to look at that evidence and to conclude that that's what happens.
You're kind of in that sweet spot where you're proposing something that both religion and science can hate equally. And even though in the big picture, it fits for both.
I know, and it shouldn't. I mean, I don't see that this should even be in conflict with religion, although I may be very naive about that because I'm not a religious person, but I know that most religions deal with some kind of afterlife. So I would think that even people who are religious would enjoy having factual data to back up what the religion is telling them. But I can't, you know, I this book is not a religious book, so I'm not dealing with that at all. I'm dealing with research and factual information that I hope doesn't create any conflicts for people with their belief systems.
Well, let's start with the first story you tell in the book, this past lives incident, because the religious beliefs of the boy's family, parents, plays a part in this, in their reluctance to accept what's going on. Tell that story.
Right. Well, this is a story about a little boy named James Leininger. He was not even 2 years old when he started to talk about things he remembered from a past life. And there was over a series of a year, I mean, I don't want to, you know, I could spend half an hour talking about it, but there were, first of all, he became obsessed with World War II airplanes. He would go crazy at the museum when he would see these planes. And then he started to have these nightmares in which he was reliving a crash in an airplane. And he was absolutely terrified. And the description I have in the book, his dad has written me some descriptions of what it was like to see his little boy in diapers, you know, curled up in his crib, just screaming in terror. And eventually he started to say, "Airplane crash on fire, little man can't get out." And he would say that over and over again as he had these nightmares. Over a period of about a year, he just started to talk about this very, very specific information that he remembered. And such as, you know, he remembered his own name, his first name in the past. He remembered the name, a full name of his friend, another pilot, the specific type of airplane that he was flying, the boat that the airplane took off from, which was an aircraft carrier that actually existed, you know, where he was shot down, who shot him down, all these specific facts. And his dad, as you mentioned, his dad was very conflicted about this because he was a Christian. And he was a devout Christian, and he did not accept that rebirth or reincarnation could possibly happen. It didn't fit into his worldview. And so every step of the way, he tried to prove his son wrong by doing all this research. And every time he did that, when new information would come through his little boy, he would prove his son was right. The data would show that. Eventually, he went to a veterans a meeting, you know, a gathering of these veterans from World War II, related to the specific Natoma Bay, which was the aircraft carrier, and he was able to find out that there was a person who fit everything that his son had told him, who had died in 1945, basically, and all the facts matched. And they actually met this man's sister, who was 84 at the time that they met her, and she became actually convinced that this little boy was her previous brother because he knew all these things about their family and their history. Lots of things that nobody else could know. And again, we're talking about a child so young who had never been exposed to any of this information. So when you have a case of a young child with specific memories that can then be traced to a specific person who actually lived, it's very compelling, and it's very hard to explain other than what the child says, which is that he was that person before. I mean, the child has absolutely no doubt about it.
Yeah, what was gave me the most goosebumps are some of the details. I mean, him knowing the plane that he flew, and I guess at one point his Corsair, American fighter aircraft,
the Corsair,
and of course in the father's research, and he puts a lot of effort into this. Father's research says, "Oh, there's no Corsair on this ship, the Natoma Bay, so there's a mistake here." But eventually, the details come out.
Right. Eventually, when they met, his father was so happy because he says, yes, he wasn't flying a Corsair, because they eventually found out the name of the person, and he wasn't flying a Corsair when he died. But when they met his sister, she sent him all these photographs in the mail. They open up the envelope, and there, standing there, is the previous person who died. His name was James Houston Jr. He was standing next to a Corsair, exactly the airplane that little James had described flying. Which was just stunning because they thought, you know, that he wasn't flying it when he died. But what was interesting was that all the veterans told James's dad that this was a plane that was so special at the time that it's the kind of thing you would remember, because the person who had died, the previous James, was assigned to fly this plane. He became an expert at flying this plane. I mean, he just stopped a couple of months before he died, and then when he actually died, he wasn't flying that plane. But it was the kind of plane that would stand out in somebody's mind because it was so special. And the plane he died in wasn't special. So it all made sense. And that was sort of the last straw for the dad. He couldn't hold out any longer when he found out that, you know, James was right about that, too.
You say you have some stories in the book about how the boy was, he would play with certain toys. He made a sort of a cockpit in the closet. And then he did a bunch of artwork that sort of recreated the scene of his death. And would sign it James 3. What's the significance of James 3?
Yeah, I mean, that's another incredible thing. When he would write his name, James 3. And, when his parents asked him with the nightmares, well, what was the name of the little man who couldn't get out of the airplane? He said his name was James. And they just thought, well, he's just talking about himself, right? So when he drew those pictures that you're talking about, George, he drew hundreds of these pictures of a plane being shot down by gunfire, very, you know, bloody pictures of all kinds of warlike stuff going on around this plane, and he would sign them James with the number 3 after it. And his parents didn't understand that because he was 3 years old at that time. This started after he turned 3. So when they would ask him, why are you writing this James 3? He said, because I'm the third James. I'm the third James. And his parents thought, well, he's just writing the 3 because he's 3 years old. You know, they didn't think too much about it. But when they found out who that person was, his name was James Houston Jr., which meant that the previous person was the second James, and indeed, the James Leininger was the third James. So that was another point that he got right.
Eventually, he gets to go to the site where he died because of a television show, and, you know,
dramatic. When he was 8 years old, they took him back to the actual place on the water where, you know, this plane had gone down, and you know, the description, I mean, of it that his dad gave me, and there is a video of it, too. He was just this normal, happy little kid going out in this boat, out in the water, you know, looking out the window, full of smiles. And as soon as they got to that location, he became incredibly quiet. They turned off the engines of the boat, and he just put his head in his mother's lap and sobbed for 15 minutes nonstop, just deep, deep grief. And they, his parents said, it's time to say goodbye to James Houston, you know, and he went through this whole internal process of saluting and saying, I'll never forget you. They had this ceremony where they threw these rose petals into the water and all this stuff for the people that had died in World War II that were connected to James Houston. But it was this very cathartic experience. And for an 8-year-old, I mean, it's not something you fake. You know, it really had this internal reality for him.
We will pick up the story on the other side and extrapolate from James's case about how many other kids have this kind of experience and what it might mean. Marvin Gaye from 1966 takes us into the break. We'll be right back with Leslie Kane and Surviving Death in just a moment. Anna Nalick from 2004, a song called Breathe. We're talking with Leslie Kane about her new book, Surviving Death. Just heard the incredible story of a young boy who recalls the intricate details of a previous life, and his parents have to come to grips with the idea that their son is the reincarnation of someone else. And they collect a lot of evidence along the way to sort of prove it, document it every step of the way. His is not an isolated case. There are hundreds that have been solved, thousands that have been considered by researchers. And when we come back, we're going to broaden the conversation with Leslie and see what conclusions we can draw from these reincarnation cases or something like reincarnation. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. Leslie Kane, we just heard a story about James, this little boy with an incredible story. How does it end up? After he comes to grips with it and his parents come to grips with it, what happens to the family?
Well, they're a completely normal family. I mean, the normal scenario is that sometime around between the ages of 5, and there are a lot of other cases, so we sort of have a norm here, but between the ages of 5 and 7, the child usually forgets the memories, and they just go on and live a normal life, and that's what happened basically. I mean, James had that very cathartic experience we talked about when he was 8, but he was already starting to forget the memories even then, and he has since then, you know, excelled in his life. He's a top student, and he's actually going to have a career in the military. I met him finally when he was 18, and he's just a very serious, you know, hardworking, normal kid. So, and this is typically what happens. Some of them it doesn't, but most of them they just move on and live a normal life.
And the idea of what typically happens, you expanded your perimeter here and engaged people who have studied this and have cases from all over the world.
Exactly. I mean, there is a center in Virginia. It's called it's at part of the University of Virginia, the Division of Perceptual Studies, and they have been studying these cases for decades. I mean, I went down there and they have just this huge volume of these hard copy files with handwritten notes through them and stuff, collected by Ian Stevenson, who was a psychiatrist who worked at the University of Virginia, and he died in 2007. And the person who is continuing that work, his name is Dr. Jim Tucker. He's a child psychiatrist. He's at the university. And he did write a chapter for my book in which he talked about cases from all over the world, just like you say. I mean, of course, we all know that these cases take place in India and places like that, and Burma, Sri Lanka. I mean, everybody sort of expects it because of their belief systems there, but it's actually, you know, that's why I focus particularly on these two American cases, that they do occur everywhere, regardless of what the religion is of the country. And this Division of Perceptual Studies has 2,500 cases on file of children who remember past lives, and 1,400 of them have been solved. And when we say solved, that means that they've actually been able to figure out who the previous person was based on the details that the child has provided, just like they did with James Leininger. They were able to find who he was in that past life. And of 350 out of those, the previous personality was a complete stranger to the family, just as he was with James Leininger. And those cases are really more evidential. In many cases in Asia, they'll have a family member will seem to be reborn. You know, a grandfather will reappear as the child in the family or something like that. But when there's no connection at all, like there was with James, and there was a big distance, too, in time between when James Houston died in 1945 and when James Leininger was born. It was 53 years. So that makes it a stronger case.
And typically, you said in the research of Jim Tucker and others, typically it's less of a time gap.
Exactly. There are many cases in which it's really not that long. It could be just a matter of a couple of years even. Sometimes it's short. So I think for the fact that the Leininger case has this long time gap makes it even more evidential. I mean, because it means that there's less likelihood that the family could know anything about that person. And in fact, of course, the Leininger family knew absolutely nothing about this person. It would have been impossible for them to have known about him. He wasn't in history books or anything like that, you know. But when somebody dies a few years before, or they live in the next town, you know, then you know, investigators can question, well, maybe the family heard something about them, but absolutely not in this case.
It makes you wonder how many hundreds or thousands of cases little kids tell their parents about memories from some previous lifetime, and it just doesn't click. That be quiet, go play in your room, kind of a thing, and it never
Exactly.
surfaces.
I mean, that was one of the reasons I wanted to write the sections on the child cases, because, and I think that's one of the reasons too that the parent of the second child I wrote about wanted to contribute to the book, because they, you know, especially when a parent has gone through this and it's very traumatic for them, they want other parents to recognize the fact that this could be happening to their child, and especially in our culture, which doesn't recognize this as being something real, it's extremely important for parents to be able to recognize when their child is dealing with something like this, especially if it involves nightmares and things that are difficult for the child. So I hope that this book will help, you know, help people to recognize it when it does happen with their children, and they won't just say, oh yeah, fantasy, or, you know, exactly like you said, go play, I don't want to hear about this.
Yeah, like
No.
you write in the book, I mean, that second case, boy, it's traumatic. It's not something that the family can ignore because it's horrible nightmares and screaming and very upsetting to everybody in the family.
Exactly. And sometimes the second child that, you know, sometimes they get confused about even who they are now. You know, I mean, the second child, Ryan Hammonds, was much more kind of enmeshed with his previous personality than James Leininger was. And he sometimes would, he'd do things like, you know, because he was very wealthy in his previous life and he had a maid, when his mom would clean his room, he thought he had to pay her for that. Because, you know, so there was sort of a, yeah, he was almost sometimes unable to separate himself from
That
it.
way he'd
And
go
that,
back and forth, kind of like he'd go back and
yeah,
forth.
but he was more, you know, more kind of a blended with it, I think, than James Leininger was. Because James would have his memories, but he would, it was just, you know, but lots of, he'd go for months and months and months and months where he wouldn't talk about it at all. Whereas I think with Ryan, it was a more continuous kind of thing. But anyway, it is very difficult. Very, I mean, this mom, and you know, I invited her to write her own chapter about her son's journey so that the reader could hear it directly from her and hear what it was like to go through this. And she didn't get much sleep for years, you know, until this thing. Although her case was solved a lot faster than James's was because they had outside help. But still, it was a very, very difficult period of time for her.
So I'm trying to imagine how a diehard skeptic, a scientist, would dismiss this. Might they say, well, the kids might have some kind of unknown psychic ability? That would be a pretty strange ability too. That would be a heck of a story by itself.
I know, I agree with that, and I think that's the only other really option we have. I mean, they could say that it was hoaxed or fraud, but you know, and you can always say that. You can say that about the best UFO case too, you know. They could say whatever they want. I'm absolutely certain that these cases, I mean, I'm 100% certain that the two cases that I cover in my book are not hoaxed. And there I go into why I know that in the book, but yeah, the only other real explanation that I can think of is that the child has some extraordinary psychic ability and for some reason, that all of that psychic energy has been used to tap into this one other life of somebody who died, you know, 40 or 50 years earlier. And maybe that's what's going on, but even that is extraordinary. And the second case I write about, the child had 55 memories that were accurate. So if he was that psychic, that's pretty incredible too, as far as I look at it, but it doesn't seem to me to be as logical an explanation as the rebirth explanation, but who knows? I mean, I don't know, because the child is certainly convinced, you know, and it's so part of their internal life. It's not like, you know, if you're doing a psychic reading about something, you might get information about something. There's a sort of a separation, though, that could happen, but with these children, it's so internalized. And they're so clear that they were that person. So, you know, the reader will make up his own mind, but I don't think there's any other real way of explaining it. I don't know if you do, but I can't come up with another way of explaining it.
I don't. Give me, so this is one of the building blocks. The idea of past lives, reincarnation, is sort of one of the building blocks in your book about surviving death. Give me the broad strokes of what you and Dr. Tucker and the other experts in this, what these cases mean when taken all together, these thousands of cases where these kids have these experiences.
Yeah, I mean, I think basically Dr. Tucker believes, you know, after having studied this for a long time, that the reincarnation explanation is the best one. I mean, he believes that that is the explanation that fits these cases better than anything else, and that somehow there's some element of our consciousness that is able to continue on from one life to the next. And that's, I think that's his, I mean, he can't prove that. And he also wishes that, you know, if more scientists took these topics on and were more respectful of it, maybe we'd learn more. But that's his conclusion, and that it's just very, very suggestive of that. And what's interesting about it is if something does survive from one life to the next, that surviving element of consciousness includes so many things. It includes memories. It includes thoughts. It includes emotions. All these things that seem to carry through that are very personal. So it's not just some kind of sort of, you know, merging consciousness where you might merge into the grand wholeness of become one with the cosmos or something like that. It's not that. It's very, very specific and personal to the individual. And so that's when I deal with this topic in my book, that's what I'm interested in exploring, is whether personal survival takes place, not whether there's some grander merging that happens, but whether we actually continue on in a recognizable form with that somebody who's still living could recognize if they were going to have a conversation with us, say.
Well, I've had the same thought. I mean, I've heard these visions of heaven or the afterlife, you know, the near-death experience thing where it's all peace and joy and light and happiness. And I've always thought to myself, that doesn't sound all that interesting. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it just seems like maybe a lot carries over. And then but again, who knows? But I think the reincarnation cases are so interesting to start with, George, because they are so clear cut. There's just no way to explain them. And they it's sort of a springboard to jump off of and ask a lot of other questions that follow. If you're going to accept that these children are actually reborn, then it brings up a lot of other questions, and you can
Other questions like the near-death experience, out-of-body experience. In my head, I sort of mesh those two together, and we've talked about them on this program previously. But I really enjoyed the story of the blue shoe, and I thought it was a great illustration of an experience that was hard to explain any other way. Share that story with us.
Yeah, that's another great one. Because if reincarnation is indeed a fact, then we have to ask whether consciousness, do we have any other evidence that suggests that consciousness can function independently of the physical body? I mean, that's the big question. And the story of the shoe on the ledge involves a veridical OBE, an out-of-body experience, which is evidential. And I'll explain why it's evidential. What happened was a social worker was working in this big hospital in Seattle, Washington. Her name is Kimberly Clark Sharp, had very, very good credentials. And she was dealing with a patient in the Harborview Medical Center who had had a heart attack, was in the hospital, and then had a second heart attack, basically. She went into cardiac arrest. She was unconscious. They were resuscitating her, but she was seriously, you know, temporarily kind of in a state of death. There was no heartbeat, there was no brain, etc. And when she came back, when she was revived, after she recovered for a few hours in the recovery room, she told Kimberly Clark that she had seen a tennis shoe when she had been quote dead. She had left her body, gone outside the building, and she'd seen a tennis shoe sitting on a ledge outside one of the windows in this massive medical center. It was a huge building. And she wanted Kimberly to go get that tennis shoe. She was very agitated, very upset, and very anxious to prove that she indeed saw this. And this is, of course, while she was lying in her bed, unconscious, right? So Kim, and to make a long story short, Kim eventually found that shoe after looking, going, walking all through the building, going to all these windows. She finally saw this window. And what's interesting about it is that the patient, Maria, had described the shoe from the perspective of being outside the window. So the details that she provided to Kimberly about what the shoe looked like, Kimberly couldn't see from inside the window when she first saw the shoe. She could see it sitting out on the ledge. But the details that Maria described were on the outer edge of that shoe. It was just so chilling. The only place she could have seen them was to be outside the building. They had to do with a scuff mark on the toe on that side and the way the shoelace was folded up underneath the sole of the shoe. So Kimberly got the shoe. She took it back to the room. Maria was, you know, crying, and it was this big emotional scene. But, you know, there you have it. She somehow knew that that shoe was out there on that ledge, which is a very strange thing in the first place. But she saw it when she was essentially brain dead, you know, essentially, close to death, unconscious, and lying on the bed being resuscitated. And so that's sort of an... The reason it's very evidential is, of course, because she was able to report back something she saw that was actually real, and that, you know, Kimberly was able to verify that that shoe actually existed. And there's no way to, you know, again, we can talk about other explanations for that, but the one that Maria just said was that she had left her body, she'd gone outside the building, and she'd seen that shoe.
That's a sort of a typical explanation or description, a near-death experience, and you make a distinction in the book of an actual death experience where people are gone, and there's still some there should be no brain activity. You're gone, and then you come back, and during that interim, people have experiences.
Right, when they're not supposed to be able to think or remember or do anything. They're supposed to not have a brain. I mean, they don't have a brain. They have no brain activity at all, and... This scientist named Sam Parnia, who, you know, he thought that the near-death experiences need to be renamed actual death experiences because he has discovered that people actually can be revived after hours of being dead. This is sort of a new thing. It used to be that everybody thought, you know, you're a certain number of minutes and your brain's gone forever. But this Sam Parnia, who's the director of resuscitation research at the Stony Brook University School of Medicine, he's an expert on this, on resuscitation, basically. And he has discovered that as long as somebody is cooled down, if the body is cold, they can be dead for hours and still come back. But then that whole time, they don't have any brain activity. So that's why he thought it should be called an actual death experience, because as far as he's concerned, that person is as dead as a corpse. During those 2 hours, let's say, when they're completely gone, they are as dead as any corpse that he, you know, they're dead. And then they fortunately, they can be resuscitated, but it involves bodies that are very cold, or somebody's fallen into a cold river or something like that.
You have cases. You have cases in the book. I'm leafing through here right now, but I can't find the page. But it's of where somebody dies, they are met by people that they know, that they don't necessarily know are already dead. They're met by right. them, and then they come back, and they find out the people that met on the other side are dead.
Right. That's about as evidential as near-death experiences can get, because they're pretty subjective. I mean, what's interesting about them is that they're uniform, that there's so many similar factors that people describe all over the world, all walks of life, and there's so many cases. But yeah, there's another case where if somebody, a child who had a near-death experience and came back, and she met this boy over there who said he was her brother, but she didn't have a brother. She came back and told her parents this and learned that, in fact, she did have a brother who had died, but she wasn't told about it. So those kinds of things do happen where people encounter, or somebody that, as you say, who they didn't even know had died, or one person described meeting a man who said he was his father. And when he went back, this was a young adult, I believe, and he went back and learned from his mother that he actually was the child of an illicit affair. And and then she showed him a picture of who his real father was, and it was the same person he saw during his near-death experience.
Is there maybe we'll not have enough time for this, but think about it for a second. When we come back on the other side, I want to get into the personal stuff, the personal experiences that you had, because one of them very directly, or two of them very directly, involve, as you mentioned, the great Bud Hopkins, who I had the pleasure of doing what might have been his last interview, at least on this program. And I just loved Bud, and he did so much important work. And anyone who has followed his career in the UFO alien abduction stuff will want to hear this story. But I also want to get an idea from you, Leslie, whether there is a thawing in the scientific community, whether something like your book, which I think is absolutely amazing, whether it could cause even the diehard skeptics to take a fair look at the evidence and reconsider. So we're gonna take a break. Creedence Clearwater Revival from 1969, a song called Lodi. Take us into the break. We'll be right back with Leslie Kane, a surviving death. A journalist investigates evidence for an afterlife. Right after this.